racing away. Perfection in equine form. A horse of a lifetime.
And he still hasn't said go on Archibald. He's laughing at his rivals.
Tyler Rowe, deeper at the gallop, up towards the line. Back-to-back nationals, the first in trade run.
The Weighed In Podcast, in association with Betfair.
Hello, and you are welcome to Weighed In association with Betfair. My name is Hugh Cahill. With me to discuss the latest issues from the world of horse racing, as always, are Mr. Kevin Blake and Mr. Tony Calvin. How are we, gentlemen?
All good.
Good, good. So, no racing in the UK. No racing in the UK, no racing in Ireland, and nothing going on, and nothing worth talking about. So, have you anything to add, lads, before we wrap this up for another week, or what's the story?
All done.
All done. Yeah, yeah. What's going on in Coronation Street, Tony, at the moment? Anything good happening over there?
Yeah, there's something very good happening. It's filming's been suspended, I think.
Right, okay, right. Another victim to the coronavirus. But look, okay, I mean, tongue-in-cheek, obviously, since we recorded last week's show, Iris Racing has been cancelled indefinitely. We don't have any kind of firm idea at the moment when it could return, Kevin. And I think, you know, despite Racing's best efforts to keep the show on the road, despite all the measures taken that we discussed on the show last week behind closed doors, it did seem inevitable that Racing would just have to follow suit with the rest of the country here and lock down so that everyone can have the best chance of getting out of this COVID-19.
Yeah, that's it, Hugh. Look, we knew it was coming. Maybe it came a little bit sooner than some were expecting, but when those announcements were made by Leo Varadkar last week, you know, I think it was clear that the end of the road had come for the time being. And sure, look, as you know yourself, and I know, you know, we're pretty much in lockdown here at the minute and will be until next week. So, look, I think the right actions have been taken by the Irish government here to give us the very best chance to flatten the curve, as they say. And sure, look, there's plans away in the background on both sides of the Irish Sea to hopefully get the show back on the road in the not-too-distant future in a safe and responsible way. But I think ultimately, on both sides of the water, it'll come down to the government, the respective governments, giving the nod for that to happen.
So it is entirely up to both governments, ultimately, but it does seem like the wheels are slowly turning, Kevin, that as soon as the early opportunity affords it, Racing will come back in some guise, whether that's behind closed doors or whatever. We'll have to wait and see. But I imagine, given the comments from Brian Kavanagh over the last few days, talking about the financial costs to racecourses, particularly in Ireland, that depend on television broadcast revenue just to survive, that as soon as they're able to get back racing, they will get back racing.
Oh, definitely. And look, I think Ireland's in a, as we've been saying for the last couple of weeks, Ireland is in a better position than the UK in terms of making this happen under, you know, very strict protocols. And the Irish, such is the size, the relatively small size of the Irish racing industry, we can function just fine with one meeting a day. And, you know, behind closed doors will work for the vast majority of tracks, I think, from a financial perspective. The likes of the Punchestown Festival would be one that there would be big question marks in that regard, but an awful lot of other racecourses would be very happy to do that. And we've shown, the Irish racing industry has shown that racing can be conducted in a safe manner behind closed doors. So look, hopefully the wider statistics in what is clearly a far bigger problem, you know, than racing not going ahead in terms of problems for society, as soon as things look a small bit rosier and restrictions start to get eased, you would imagine that HRI and everyone else would be ready to get going again as soon as the relevant authorities are happy for them to do so. Yeah,
I guess the position is, Tony, that Ireland does seem to be in a slightly better position than the UK right now, just because of the actions taken by the government at earlier stages than perhaps Boris Johnson and his Conservative government over there. So it must make it a little bit unusual, perhaps, for racing fans in the UK to be looking at Ireland potentially coming back sooner than the UK. And what's your view on that?
Well, I think, like everyone said at length, you have a situation whereby the regulatory bodies of football, of racing, of greyhound racing, they haven't really got any control over the situation. So I think what the BHA have done, they've set out their case in some detail. You know, they're You know, they say we're ready when the country's ready. So I think what they've done is very good. But what I don't think they've been very pleased by is, you know, trainers coming out and, you know, and giving the BHA angle a very bad look. I mean, you've got Rafe Beckett coming out and being very vocal again. You know, you had William Jarvis of the NTF come out and saying, you know, if racing comes back very soon, it'll be a boost for the nation. Now, come on, it's not going to be a boost for the nation on May the 1st, is it? I think sport in general and some participants in racing, they need to start thinking in terms of bodies and bags, not pounds and pence here, because, you know, it's a very bad look for sport going on the front foot and saying, yeah, we want to get back. There was a piece in the Daily Mail today saying, oh, football wants to get back on early May and finish their current season by July, in mid-July. I mean, it's all about money. And when you put money at the, you know, over and above people's health and safety, you know, say it's only going to end one way. So in one respect, football really mouthing off to the degree that they are will actually work in racing's favour. But I think the less said now, the better. The BHA have got a plan in place should this situation ease. I don't think anything more needs to be said. I think you should let the regulatory body dictate the tempo and dictate the message.
Well, Ralph, you know, and I tell you, sorry, Tony, sorry, Hugh, I was a little bit surprised that those plans were made public when they were, for that reason you mentioned. You know, I don't think they needed to be made public. And I, from a PR point of view, and I don't know if it was the intention for them to be made public. I know Rafe Beckett put them up on Twitter. And like you say, you know, it's all about timing and you have to read the room a little bit. And, you know, while it's important that those plans are in place, do you necessarily need to let the public know that they're in place when they're no. really more so relevant to the industry participants than the public That's themselves?
Yeah, that's what really irked me. You have the situation whereby, you know, Greyhound racing, I think, is in a better position to come back before horse racing, you know, purely because of the, you know, the lack of human participants. And their promoters are angling for a return on April the 12th. Now, that might be optimistic or fanciful, no matter, you know, how whatever your view is on it. But we've got a situation where on Wednesday, we're going to get Wimbledon, the tennis tournament, going to be officially cancelled, and that's not even due to start to June the 29th. So I think, you know, if for racing, or sorry, the people in people like Rafe Beckett or people like, you know, William Jarvis or anybody involved in racing to say, we're primed and ready to start on May the 1st, just shut up. Just let the BHA and let the government and let the situation dictate when you go, and but just be ready to go when you are. I don't think anybody seriously thinks that May the 1st is a potential runner. But then again, you know, we don't know what the next month's going to bring.
Well, Rafe Beckett would make the point, Tony, and he has made the point that, look, I mean, if you give people a definitive date of when we could possibly return, if people can see some sort of light at the end of the tunnel, then they can keep their horses in training, keep their fees going, and the industry continues to tick over even without racing. If people don't have any kind of reasonable degree of idea when racing might return, it's very difficult for them to pay for their horses to be trained.
Yes, I understand that, but that doesn't need to be done in public, does it? I mean, every trainer will speak to their owners on a daily basis during all this. The BHA speaks to the trainers, the trainer speaks to their owners, the trainers speak to their jockeys, and, you know, the BHA speaks to the PGA. Just do it as much as possible behind closed doors. You have a situation whereby this Daily Mail have got an exclusive on the football looking to start on May the 12th, you know, until early July and get their season finished. I mean, I'm sure the Premier League wouldn't like that to have come out, because you have a situation where the less said in this situation, the better, because public perception and all this is going to be key here. And if people are talking about openly saying we need to get racing again, we want to be ready on May the 1st, and people were being told in press conferences, in the Prime Minister press conferences, that this could linger on for 3 to 6 months. It's going to look really, really bad from a greed perspective. So I would just say to all the trainers, just make your thoughts behind closed doors. Don't play it out in the press, because they're not coming out of this looking very well in my eyes.
Yeah,
well,
Kev, I can understand old Ralphie's position on this. You know what I mean? Like, I can get where he's coming from. What are you laughing?
You're going to get a phone call.
Listen to me. I'm an Irish man. Ralph is Ralph with an L in it, right? You have to pronounce the L. I once called Ralph Keyes Rave Keyes as a bit of a joke over a pint, and I got a punch in the chops for it. I'm not moving that. Anyway, I can understand Ralph's position, Ken. What do you reckon?
Look, this is going to be so difficult to you because, like we've talked about for weeks in this podcast about the potential for racing to shut down. The trickiest part in this whole situation isn't so much making the call to shut down racing or shut down sporting events. The trickiest decision is going to be when the government say, okay, we're happy for you to go again, because this virus isn't going away. And it's going to be there for many, many, many months, I strongly suspect. And at what point is the curve sufficiently flattened or new cases sufficiently reduced for you to say, okay, go ahead behind closed doors, okay, go ahead with attendees again? These are really, really difficult decisions. And, you know, while some, you know, won't quite be happy until everything is shut down and our country's grind to a halt, you know, it is very important that we have something to come back to when we get to the far side of this. So, look, like I've been saying all along, if activities can be conducted, you can never completely remove risk, but with the lowest possible risk to spreading the virus and so on, that can generate economic activity. You know, we have to be very open to the possibilities of giving that a crack. And the likes of greyhound racing, yeah, the likes of horse racing, in terms of sports that generate a lot of economic activity, they're better kitted out than most to do that. So while we have to read the room and we have to be cautious of of looking to make moves to get back going at a time when people are dying and people are suffering, you know, we do have to do our best to get back going as soon as we can. And some people would read that quite cynically, and that's fine. But, you know, that's the economic reality we're also confronted with in this, you know, very serious crisis we're all facing.
I mentioned how the race courses are going to struggle and you know, financially. So it remains to be seen if any of them do, in fact, go under from the lack of revenue generated during this really difficult time. The Racing Post as well, to give people just an idea of how hard the industry has been hit, has stopped printing for the first time in its 34-year history, Tony. I mean, that'll give you an idea of how the horse racing industry in general is just really struggling at the moment.
Yeah, one thing before we come on to that, I'd just say about, Kevin mentioned the financial aspect of all this, and don't get me wrong, you know, having had a pub at certain trainers, etc., you know, they're suffering hardship here, as are their owners. And I spoke to Alan Del Monte from the levy board earlier in the week, and this is quote unquote, said our financial position, that we have gone from circa £8 million a month income to zero. And so our immediate priority has been to ensure we are funding what needs to be funded and looking to reduce discretionary spend. Stage two is that racing bodies collectively, headed by the BHA, are working on a coordinated submission around where additional funding is necessary. So they're going to await their response, and then they're going to apply to that. That gives you some idea of the financial hole that racing is in at the moment. So £8 million for nothing. As regards other media outlets, I mean, the Racing Post, you know, I'm sitting here on my wall. I've got their first edition there from April 1986, and it didn't used to publish 7 days a week in the early stages. But when Sunday Racing came in, it's basically been, you know, it's been one completely free run at this. And obviously, so I've got, you know, I've got a few friends still there, far less if they read Twitter. But as much as I do, kind of like pull up some poor journalism there. I mean, I still got a massively soft spot for the paper, not so you'd notice. But so yeah, I just think the whole racing media at the moment is in a state of flux. I mean, you have a situation whereby a lot of these media outlets now, whether it be, you know, other outlets like Timeform, whatever, they are reliant on betting revenue. So when betting shuts down, it does affect their editorial output as well. So it's a very, very poor situation. You've got a situation, obviously, a lot of them have gone into furlough at the moment, and that's been replicated across the industry and other outlets as well. So it's going to affect TV stations. It's going to affect the Racing Post. So the sooner we get through this, the better. But, you know, let's not make greed or self-interest the story here. Let's just make this just make, you know, getting the situation right in our country, then we can go forward. It's for this, I mean, very briefly before I let Kevin go on, it's kind of like the way I view this is, I mean, this is why I've come off Twitter for a bit. I mean, I came off Twitter last Friday because my provocative kind of like stroke playful style just didn't seem to be right in the current climate. It doesn't need me going and, you know, digging people out and making jokes. And we just have a situation whereby now I think we're going to have to rein back a bit and just let this situation play out and then, you know, let the financial kick in as and when. But clearly racing media, even before this, was in a pretty tight spot as regards to exposure and just simple coverage.
Tony's just a big softy, Kev, isn't he? I mean, he only hammers the Racing Post every day because he loves them.
No, well, as someone said to me one time, and it stuck with me, always listen to your critics because they care. They wouldn't be offering criticism if they didn't care. So yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe Tony loves the Racing Post.
There you go. It's like
I joined there in 87. I only went there for 6 weeks just before going to university and ended up staying for 12 years. So
I worked for the Racing Post as well. I was writing spotlights for them for about 3 years there from 2010 onwards.
All right. Any winners?
The odd winner. But yeah, that was it. But
is it a fair criticism, Kevin, just Tony's last point there, that the racing media, and we're not singling out the Racing Post here, but the racing media as a whole has not been addressing perhaps issues within the sport that maybe deserve more serious concern? Is that a fair criticism, do you think?
I think racing journalism has changed quite quickly, you know, and I'm still a relatively young man, but I've seen a fair bit of change in my relatively limited amount of time in the game. And, you know, you can't talk about the racing media without talking about the Racing Post, because they are the inverted commas trade paper. And when people talk about the racing media, a lot of focus inevitably is on the RP. They've changed. You know, they've changed a lot in the last three, four, 5 years.
In my
opinion, a lot of the more experienced writers have been let go or have been made redundant or various other arrangements. And you know, I think it's fair to say that the average age of the writers in the Racing Post has dropped massively. And you have some very young and some very talented people being given a lot of prominence. And look, that's fine. And that's fine. But, you know, it does make me, and I'll just be a little bit straight here, it's something that makes me a small little bit uncomfortable at times when, you know, very young, in quite a few cases, talented people at the Racing Post are being put on a bit of a pedestal in tipping roles. Because that is a tough gig, and Tony will tell you, he knows as well as anyone. Yeah. You know, if you're tipping on a big platform in racing, and you're on social media, that is a tough spot, because the nature of the game is you will tip more losers than winners, and even the likes of, you know, Hugh Taylor, who's been a massive winner in the long term, year after year for many, many years. You see, when he goes on a losing run, he'll get it on social media, so. For these very young people to be put in that sort of a position, it does concern me a little bit that giving them such a platform at a relatively young age risks sending them the wrong way. It's tough to deal with, and it's tough when you're a mature adult, because we're all human at the end of the day. But when you're young, you're still finding your way, finding your confidence. To be put in a position, and I'm sure they all want to be doing what they're doing. Of course, everybody wants to get on, but it's a brutal thing, tipping in this day and age. And I just worry that we might, you know, it wouldn't be a problem if they were lining up out the gates down the street, young people with a great interest in horse racing, with a great amount of talent, looking to get into racing journalism. If there was loads of them, it wouldn't be a problem. Throw them all in the deep end and keep the ones that swim. But the problem is, I don't think we have loads of young people bursting down the doors to come in. And I think while no one wants to be slowed down and be broken in slowly, you know, I think it might be and this is purely my own opinion. It's not really my place to comment on how other people do business. But as an observer from the outside, you know, I think it might be a little bit more sympathetic and better in the long term for these young people coming into the game, just to bring them in a little bit more slowly. And don't
That's only one aspect. I mean, Tony, like I get the sense from what you said that you perhaps feel that there has been an editorial shift in the stance of maybe the RP and even other media outlets as well that built up over the years. There has been a kind of massive shift editorially as to how coverage has been presented and what's been covered.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been thus to a certain degree because racing is a very insular profession, isn't it? And if you slag a trainer or a jockey off, you're gonna meet them within a week, and that's not always the case in the likes of rugby or football. So, racing journalists have always been very mindful about who they criticise and how they criticise. But you just have to look at the changing landscape of racing journalism. You've got, since Alan Lee sadly passed away, and he really fought racing's corner in the Times, and you know he got loads of exposure. For racing in that organ. You know, since he's gone, you know, the Times haven't got a full-time racing correspondent. The Independent went by the wayside ages ago. You've got the Daily Star, the Express and the Mirror are pretty much as one now. You've got racing journalism is basically on its arse. And what really annoys me, and it saddens me more than annoys me, it's, you know, the best stories often aren't covered. We had a situation, you know, Sheikh Mohammed, massive story. I think only three journalists covered it that I know. Johnny Ward, Roy DeLaghi wrote something at the Irish Field, and somebody else wrote something, and it was briefly touched upon on Luck on Sunday with Richard Hoyles and Nick Luck. So the best stories often get covered because the best stories are gonna affect people's day-to-day relationships. So, and I think racing people need to grow a pair about how they approach stories and how they're allowed to do stories. And I think the case in point recently is obviously the most recent example is Dundalk, where obviously the Tony the Gent Yufton, where everyone saw it on the Friday. It doesn't need me to go into the ins and outs of that yet again because we covered it last week. But you know, I think Kevin has done a piece on it. He put his head above the parapet first. Johnny Ward's did a piece on it. Outside of that, I haven't seen nothing. I mean, the Racing Post barely covered it. ITV, I asked them about it, and Ed Chamberlain came back to me on Twitter. We had a DM chat about it, and it's not something they thought it was suitable for their audience. If you don't highlight the big stories in racing, as troubling as they may be from a integrity point of view or whatever, you know, it's never going to get worse. We, you know, the Dundalk story is just a classic recent example, following on from the Sheikh Mohammed story, whereby it's a really lovely, meaty subject for anybody to go to their sports editor and say, look, I've got this. There's so many strands to this story. Let me run with it. Let me get behind the scenes. Let me dig, as Johnny Ward did and as Kevin did, and I'll present you with something your readers want to read. And as for ITV and the other racing channels, maybe want to listen to, because everyone who saw that knows what the story is, but they just want it, the flesh on the bones.
The problem is, Tony, that, you know, if you're making an editorial decision here on something that is being investigated, whereby no outcome has been concluded, you are leaving yourself open if the investigation doesn't go on to prove what you might suggest or to go on to show a story in a certain light as has been written. So if you're going to publish, if you're going to entertain a story like that on television, if you're going to publish it in a newspaper article, you must be pretty sure that everything that you put into it can be stood over. And I think the wariness now from newspaper editors is that sometimes it's just not worth the risk.
But if you present the fact, everything's, you know, something like this will be lawyered. I went on Racing TV and me and Tom Stanley did it off the cuff, as I alluded to last week. You know, you are going to get people dissuading you or trying to dissuade you from writing articles, from covering it, for the reasons I've just explained. But, you know, you have to stand firm. As long as you present your case in a legal, in a structured and in a factual framework, then everything should be game on all around the track. I mean, there's been a lot of you know, stories that I'm sure racing and rugby would could rather have done without. I mean, we like our rugby union. A classic example of that would be the Saracen story, and that took 3 or 4 years to really get going from the first rumours, doesn't it? So there are avenues whereby these stories can be addressed, and they're very, very interesting. And there's too many people just willing to play, you know, the short term game, you know, and keep their relationships and not trying to, you know, and trying to just continue their relationships and not query those. I mean, I just think racing without proper analysis is and without proper introspection, I think it's suffering. And I think if you have a press that hasn't got any bite, you know, you're not giving your sports head as much to go to war with, are you?
Okay, all right. Well, one story that I thought was very interesting, and somebody who didn't leave certainly Kevin didn't shy away from confrontation, was Chris Gordon, who's the Irish Horse Racing Regulatory Board's head of security. He took a defamation case, won last week a unanimous verdict against the Irish Racehorse Trainers Association in the High Court. He was awarded €300,000 and his costs and damage. Those costs, by the way, exceeded €1 million in total. And it does leave the Irish Racehorse Trainers Association in a very precarious position. It's a bizarre case in many ways, Kevin. It has rambled on for a long, long time, and we finally came to a conclusion last week. What is your sense of what's happened here?
Oh, it should never really have happened, to be honest to you. And, you know, Chris Gordon would tell you this himself. You know, this isn't something that should have escalated to the point where it did. You know, it's been well covered in the Irish field. And Brian Sheeran in the Racing Post, to be fair, has been covering this the whole way through and has had some good stories on it. But, you know, this has just gone on for years and years and years. It all stems back to an investigation arising from the infamous John Hughes case. The vet in Ireland, and it was nasty. It was a nasty old case. Chris Gordon felt he was wronged, went to court to fight his corner, and has won. And there will be wider ramifications. We should say that the representatives of the legal representatives of the Irish Racehorse Trainers Association have suggested that they will appeal. So it might not be quite over yet, but if this decision is upheld, you know, one can only imagine, and obviously open to correction, not being familiar with their accounts, this will put the Irish Racehorse Trainers Association out of existence, because they surely can't cover the costs of what this case is going to cost them. Again, open to correction on that, of course, but this is... It's just a case in point that when solicitors get involved, things escalate very quickly. And what is a relatively small thing that wouldn't have mattered a whole lot wouldn't have meant a lot to a huge amount of people turns into a case that has ended up, you know, with a 2 million swing either way. But look, we'll see what the appeal brings. It's worth reading up on this, the details of it, because it's an interesting case if you're into that type of thing.
Well, there were seven strands of defamation, Kevin, instance. Only one of those was not put to the jury. So of the seven, six were put to a jury who decided that Gordon was defamed in all bar one of the others. So it's a very comprehensive verdict on the jury's part. And when you look at the parties involved on the Trainers Association side as well, there's some pretty heavy names there. Who are now, as you say, considering an appeal. It's just a strange one, all told. And, you know, I guess Chris Gordon now will say, look, he wants to get on with his life. He wants to put this behind him. But this one could ramble on even further still.
It could do. And look, to kind of nutshell this as best I can, you know, Chris Gordon was involved in an investigation that involved the inspection of a number of trainers' premises. And there was the Trainers Association had issues with the way those investigations were being conducted. And the ultimate allegations were that there was a campaign to undermine Chris Gordon and try to get him out of his position as head of security with the IHRB. And that was basically what happened and what Chris Gordon was fighting against. So, look, it's been going on an awful long time. You know, I think that one of the main things that were of issue here was an interview that was published in the Irish Field in August 2014. So we're going back an awful long way. And if I think I'm nearly sure. Again, open to correction. That Brian Sheeran said in the Racing Post at one stage that this was the longest, if not the longest, running defamation cases in Irish legal history, which is quite remarkable. Because it, again, to an outsider looking in, it doesn't seem like that big of a deal. But there you go, and that's the decision that was made. And sure, look, we'll see if what transpires with the appeal, if indeed it is lodged. But it's gone on too long really already, and it's going to have big ramifications certainly for the Irish Racehorse Trainers Association.
Branching it out, Kev, I mean, did you see those integrity stats that were announced today from Ireland? Did you have a look at that?
I pay great attention to these every year, and I'd normally write something about them. There's always
What stood out to me is there was only 27 racing and rider inquiries in Ireland in 2019. I nearly fell off my chair.
Yeah, but
27.
You thought that was too much, Tony? Did you?
Oh yeah, Jim. The only time that Barry gets on his high horse is when Barry Orthis is. When someone went on Twitter and questions Ireland integrity, Irish racing integrity, he went on there and said, "We've got the cleanest racing in the world." And I did raise an eyebrow or two there. But the figures back him up. Only 27 racing and riding inquiries.
Yeah, I've tended to write about that particular aspect of these stats every year now for 4 or 5 years. It's never fails to raise my eyebrows either, Tony. Because look. There's, I think, glancing at the statistics again, I haven't hammered them down, but there was in the region of about 31,000 individual runners between Flat and National Hunt in Ireland in 2019. And like you say, 27 running and riding inquiries, which is in layman's terms, they're non-trier inquiries. So that implies that Irish racing is incredibly clean and the integrity is absolutely undeniable. But unfortunately, even the great lovers of Irish racing like myself that watch this very closely and have done for quite some time would admit that those numbers are not really reflective of the reality. We had a situation in 2007, at the beginning of 2017, where we had new non-trier rules introduced in Ireland. The quote from Dennis Egan, the head man in the IHRB at the time, he called them the most complete running and riding regulations in any jurisdiction. And when you read down through that, they are extremely comprehensive. They give you they give the stewards a great amount of power, and it reduces the burden of proof. You know, when you read them, you'll be delighted with them. But it doesn't matter how good the rule is if the race day stewards are unwilling to put their heads above the parapet and to enforce them, you know, because ultimately last year, of the 27 inquiries, we had how many suspensions? Bear with me and I'll chase them up. It was two or three off the top of my head. Yeah, it was two. Yeah, so two non-trier bans in the whole of 2019 from 31,000 runners.
I saw 27 cases to answer in a 26-runner Furl's maiden hurdle fortnight ago. So I don't know where they get that 27 from.
Well, that's it. And look, my argument for many, many years with this is, you know, and I've been into stewards' rooms on race days. You know, they brought me in a couple of times, and you know, they have an awful lot going on race days. And look, my argument has been all along that I think it's very easy to throw stones at them, and I often do, to be fair. But they do have an awful lot on. And my view for a long time has been that racing, not just Irish racing, British racing as well. And to be fair, I think there are little moves in the background towards it. I think they'd be much better off having a rotating panel of professional stewards that are remotely based, and their job is solely to watch every race in great, great detail and call inquiries remotely. The stewards on the track can be used to simply collect the evidence from the participants, and then it gets referred, and all of these cases are dealt with week by week on a Monday, on a Tuesday, and any punishments are dished out then. Because I think I watch racing probably closely more closely than the vast majority of people. And if you're going to watch every runner in every race, it takes time. it takes time, and the turnover in terms of the amount of time the stewards have to deal with each race, it isn't sufficient. So it's unfair to expect them to see everything. But the frustrating thing is when you see what most reasonable judges of racing would consider a very eye-catching case, and there isn't even an inquiry. You know, that's quite frustrating. And I think that we can certainly do a better job in Britain and Ireland with a view to asking more questions. Just because something is eye-catching, it doesn't mean there was wrongdoing, but we owe it to the racing public to ask questions so that there isn't this vacuum created where people can fill in the gaps themselves and throw stones at the sport.
To be fair to Ireland here, again, to balance this out, I mean, they are transparent figures, if you know, even if you find them laughable or not, but I'm not aware of any similar submission from the BHA or any announcement along these lines from the BHA either over here. So perhaps we should be applauding Ireland for at least releasing all these figures in their entirety. Like I said, if they are published by the British Horse Racing Authority over here, I'm not aware of them.
Yeah, there's loads of interesting stuff in there, to be fair. You can the Irish Field have posted a link to the document. It's a meaty enough document. I don't know, there's heaps of pages there. But you get everything from, you know, breakdowns of the amount of non-runners day by day, the analysis of the off times, analysis of ratings, applications for trainers' licenses, loads and loads of stuff. So if numbers are your thing, it's worth chasing up. But yeah, that's always, every time this comes out, every February or March, the running and riding inquiries is the first thing I flick to, because I'm particularly interested in that aspect.
Just a quick shout to our listeners as well, and just to remind them as well, if they have any suggestions for topics of discussion that they'd like us to cover, they can do so on Twitter at Betfair Racing. And just, I suppose, given the times that we're in, all suggestions are very much welcome. And thanks for your support so far on the podcast. Tony, I guess my main question to you for the podcast this week is, who are you going to back in the virtual Grand National?
this will be your cup of tea now, Tony. I can tell.
He's Kev. He's a huge fan of the virtual Grand Nationals. It's just consuming his week.
Yeah. I'm going to follow in whoever's put this together. Am I missing something? There's got to be some integrity issue here, isn't there?
Well, I'll put it to you like this, Tony. You know the WWE wrestling?
Yeah.
There is betting on that. You can have a bet on WrestleMania if you want. And there's someone somewhere that knows the results of those events before they happen. But absolutely. Some people quite happily bet on them.
Yeah.
I always remember, this is a blast from the past for some people, Peter Sandovich from Stan James used to price all that stuff up in the 80s and 90s. Yeah, I mean, I think they had a lopsided book on occasions, that's for sure. But yeah, I mean, but it stands to reason, right? I mean, although, you know, there's a charity element to this, isn't there? I mean, I think Betfair and all books are giving all their profits from this, if any, to the NHS. So, you know, there is a clear positive out of this. But surely the people who run this and who program this or this nonsense or whatever, surely they're going to have to run the race before they give it to ITV to run live, just to check it works. They're not going to risk, you know, doing it live on ITV and the stuff doesn't work. So they're going to have to know the result, somebody, aren't they?
Yeah, I wouldn't be getting too worked up myself now. I think it'd be grounds for sacking if there's suspicious betting patterns.
Yeah,
and it traces it back to the guy that programmed it.
I mean, yeah. Speaking of working and getting worked up, Kev, I still haven't forgiven Shawn Michaels for turning on Marty Jannetty and the Rockers back in WrestleMania 6. I'm disgusted. So I don't know. Right, listen. I got to ask you both because the Tiger Roll documentary goes live on all Betfair channels tomorrow from noon. Obviously bidding for three in a row at Aintree this season, which did not come to pass, even his effort, as we know. But in terms of a documentary, Tony, I know you watched it, Kev, as well. It was just great to look back on one of the public's most affectionate horses over the last couple of years and see how he went to do it. I really enjoyed it, I have to say.
Yeah, when I looked at it this morning, and the tagline was not overly big but immaculately put together. So I actually thought it was about me. But I watched it, and it's complete. So yeah, it's fascinating. You're going from the early stages, obviously, to the Cheltenham second recently. It's a pretty definitive tale, that's for sure. I think it could benefit from a bit of an editor's touch, maybe tighten it up. But but it's certainly if you
it's
love
only
45
your 45 minutes, Tony, for God's sake, it's not that long. Your attention span is out of a fly running up all these days. All your virtual Grand National betting, that's what
the virtual Grand National will take 10 minutes. This is only took 45.
Yeah. No, I really enjoyed it. And I thought everybody, you know, came across as so invested in the horse as well. And the story behind, you know, the fact that he was almost gone, the injury that he picked, how he started off his career, I thought it was just, for people who don't know his backstory, I thought it was great.
No, yeah. I loved it. I thought it was really good. You know, they did great bits with Nigel Hawk there at the beginning, and I just thought it was very well put together. You know, very nicely edited. There was one moment that's just sticking out to me, and I only watched it just before we started recording this, so it's quite fresh in my mind. There was one, and look out for this moment, because I just thought it was a beautiful piece of editing. And they're talking about, this is when Tiger was in his low years, and I forget who was speaking at the time, but it might have been Gordon. And he made mention of the fact that, you know, Tiger was maybe one run away from the sales, but so he must have heard us and turned it all around. And as those words are being spoken, they have a shot of Tiger roll out in the field with his head down grazing, and all of a sudden he throws his head up and pricks his ears. And I just thought it was very nice. There's great thought gone into it. It was very nicely edited. It gets your emotions up as well. You know, the second grand, the first Grand National, you know, the photo finish being announced, Davy Russell's face, you know, it was a really good piece of whatever you want to call it, television, a documentary. I think anyone that has any sort of an interest in racing, and an awful lot of people that have no interest and just like sports, will be well grabbed by this. And I hope it should be, and I hope it's picked up in loads of different places, because with a lack of live sport on television, something like this will have a fantastic place to fill.
Let's just hope he seals it all with a win in the virtual Grand National on Saturday.
Yeah.
A fairy tale ending. To be serious, going back to the media angle about and how pressurised it is, I think when you get content like this, and you know, for other bookmakers as well through various channels, some of the content you've got coming out from bookmakers now really puts, you know, TV stations on the back foot and other journalists as well with the blogs, etc. I mean, you something like this is, you know, you could easily just transport that from the Betfair site or whatever it is. I'm sure you'll tell us where you can watch it in a moment, but you can transport that to ITV on Saturday in an instant, couldn't you, without any editing whatsoever? Maybe tightening up a couple of minutes. But yeah.
like you say, Tony, and we've said it before about the racing media and that, you know, there's very, very few people or organisations within racing that would invest the sort of time and money that it takes to produce a full-length documentary like this. Like, the amount of time that has gone into this is something else. And like you say, it's just a... it's a very slick, you know, cinema quality production, really.
Yeah, where can you view that, yeah?
Betfair YouTube from noon tomorrow. So this is obviously Tuesday, from Wednesday, noon tomorrow, on all Betfair social media channels, and from the YouTube Betfair channel as well. I was kind of thinking as well, just in terms of Gordon Elliott, because like I've kind of really followed Gordon's career closely over the last few years, Kevin, and he's had a wonderful few years, you know, all things considered. When you think back to Silver Birch, really, which kind of launched him into the public limelight. And Gordon at 42 years of age, like, it's not probably unrealistic to say that Willie Mullins at 64, how long is he going to keep training? And, you know, over the next kind of 5-6 years, are we looking at a stage where Gordon Elliott in the next kind of 5 to 10 years could completely dominate the racing landscape? And in Ireland, certainly, do you think, or in the UK, or how do you think the picture is developing?
Well, sure. Look, Willie Mullins didn't really get a role until he was 50.
Yeah, you know, Gordon, scary.
Gordon is in a great position. But look, there will be a succession plan there for Willie Mullins as well. Don't worry about that. You have Patrick there that's as sharp as a tack, and you'd imagine he'll be continuing on that operation with a great amount of ambition and endeavour. So I think that rivalry will keep going, even if whether it's Willie's name on the license or so, or Patrick's or whoever's. But it reflects very well on Gordon, this documentary as well. And, you know, just in terms of a wider point, And you know, especially, you know, in our both our Britain and Ireland, I suppose there's an awful lot of kind of families that are locked up together in lockdown. And even if your family or whoever it is you live with isn't into racing, you know, I think people that love the sport have a bit of a job on now to be good ambassadors for the sport. Sit your family members down and get them to watch this with you. It's very accessible. You don't need to be into racing. And, you know, something like this could just spark curiosity and interest in people that don't necessarily pay a lot of attention to racing right now and potentially be the spark. Because things like this don't happen. This is Red Rum stuff, what Tiger Roll is doing. And it just potentially grabs some people and get them into the game where they might not otherwise be. So be a good racing ambassador. Sit your family down in front of this and get them to enjoy it. Or give them the chance to enjoy it. I suspect they will.
And by the way, having read Patrick's stuff over the last couple of months in particular, Kev, I've actually have a fiver on him to win either the Pulitzer or the Booker Prize at some stage over the next.
No, I'm quite happy for Pat. I'm quite happy for Patrick to take over from Willie now and stay away from the racing journalism because he's very good, isn't he?
He's absolutely brilliant. And fair play to him. Look, a very clever guy and just a brilliant guy overall as well. Okay, lads, I think that's pretty much us done for this week. As this story, in terms of the industry itself, keeps moving every few days, and I'm sure there will be plenty more to get our teeth into next week. Enjoy the Tiger Roll documentary. We'd love to hear, by the way, your feedback on any of the Betfair Racing social media channels over the next few days, and let us know what you think. And as I said, topics for discussion. If you have anything in racing that you think we need to get stuck into, please let us know on the Betfair Twitter account, the Betfair Racing Twitter account, or you can get in touch with Betfair themselves. My thanks to Tony and to Kevin, as always, for their time. Betting.betfair.com. We'll talk to you next week. And please, as always, gamble responsibly.